Well, so far you've heard my voice, but then I brought two friends along. Next on the mic is my man, Jer. Come on, Jer, sing that song.
David Tyler.
Subscribe now to the OTB Football Podcast stream wherever you get your podcasts and download the OTB Sports app.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power's Save Our Game. Is your bookie giving you jack? Then you haven't tried Paddy Power. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
So a week is a long time in football. Daniel McDonald, hello, of the Irish Independent. How are you doing?
Hey, Joe, how are things? Yeah, I mean, it is a long time. I mean, what was happening this time last week? England-Denmark was about to, you know, was in, that was all that was consuming our mind was England-Denmark. And here we are now, the tournament's done. England are done.
8 days, even longer. So you and I spoke last Tuesday, as we often do. And at that stage, Italy and Spain were vying for a place in the final. England-Denmark was over the horizon. England-Italy was a lifetime away. And now here we are. So we'll consider this something of a wrap on the tournament. We've talked in the past 48 hours to Kevin Kilbane, to Pat Nevin, Gabriella Mercotti, Matt Slater. I want to get your thoughts. And we'll talk Irish football as well, because European action is, well, we're in the throes of it now, and there's more to come tomorrow with Bohemians. So what's endured beyond the football? Carnage at Wembley in particular, and I suppose this Tory government versus the footballers continues. But curious to get your thoughts on the football, if we could, firsthand. So Gareth Southgate, I think in the main, to some extent or other, has been criticised for his handling of the final. How damaging do you think this final has been to Southgate?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, like, there's no doubt that the last 48 hours, and listen, I've been listening to some of the sort of powerful interviews that have taken place, and it has overshadowed, and listen, it's an important discussion to have, you know, that it's overshadowed probably what was a great football competition and the football side of it. How damaging to Southgate? Yeah, it's a good question. Like, I mean, I guess there's no doubt that a feeling exists out there that England, that this is one that's got away from England, you know, and that's obviously, it's not the story of valiant failure, you know, it's not the moral victory type sort of thing. It's more, oh no, like this is possibly the best chance England. It's very hard for them to replicate even that opportunity. For all that, I think that the work that they've done means that they're going to be knocking on the door regularly over the next decade. They may never get a tournament that's stacked so much towards them. And it's interesting, like, you know, can you have a go at Southgate strongly when it's his sense of conservatism probably brought them to that stage in the competition? But then, you know, would they have got through the competition anyway, even with a more progressive outlook because of maybe the teams that they played? You know, it seems like he did do a lot of work towards making his team more solid, and in terms of personal decisions that were made, that clearly they weren't going to sort of completely unleash the attacking talent they had. And like that's the sort of philosophy that probably carried them a long way to it. And it's a bit like, you flip it, you'll have a team who'll try to play passing football and it works for them, and if they give a ball away at the edge of their box, you know, from overplaying it, you sort of have to, you can't just say, well, they should have lumped it. It's like, well, their philosophy is to play this way, so that's the risk you take. But you sort of wonder, in game on Sunday, should he have just been a bit bolder and thrown off the shackles a bit? And I suspect, I don't know if you saw him on Monday, obviously he was, like, there was a lot going on, and his post-mortem questions had a broader social theme to it as well, beyond the football. But I thought he looked devastated, and I think maybe he knows that they let this one get away, and his decisions. But it, like, damaging, I don't know. He's got a contract, and it seems like they want to extend his contract, so I don't think there's any implications. But certainly, if they get to Qatar next Christmas, which is actually how it technically is, next December, and they're in a quarterfinal game against an opponent of some substance, then clearly the shadow of Wembley is going to hang over his decisions, and that's when he'll be really scrutinised, I think.
Yeah, I tend to agree. And in the interim, between now and Christmas, regardless of how England play, even if it's champagne football all the way, I'll still have my suspicion that once they get to Qatar, it will be batten down the hatches again. This seems to be Southgate's approach. He seems pretty wedded to it. And I don't know, it's going to be interesting to see if the criticism and the talk in advance of the World Cup forces a rethink on his part. It seems, talking to Mark Lawrenson and talking to a couple of people who've heard things through the grapevine, that Southgate and Steve Holland did some kind of study almost of tournament football and have come to the definite conclusion that defence wins these things.
Yeah, and yet, wasn't it the highest scoring tournament in some time, this one, you know, goals per game. So trends change and evolve too. You know, like it was, it was a tournament where, yeah, I know that Italy have a sort of legendary central defensive figures, but actually, you know, Italy were bold, really, in their play. And it was it was maybe un-Italian in terms of, like, stereotypes. So Southgate's thesis and Steve Holland's thesis may be correct, but it may have been overtaken by events. Like, you know, we had a thrilling tournament there with sort of, you know, games finishing sort of 5-3 and, you know, 3-all and knockout ties. So, you know, maybe, you know, was it the teams who took more risks at certain times that prevailed to a certain extent? But, I mean, listen, there was obviously, there was a solidity about the teams that progressed. But even, you know, Denmark scored a lot of goals as well, even though they got to the semi-finals. You know, like, but I understand, like, you started competition with an approach and you think, well, we're going to see it through this way. I mean, they didn't concede a goal from play until the final. And actually, I mean, the two goals that they conceded in the competition were dead balls, you know. Mm. So you could probably point to that as justification. I mean, if England had held out to win 1-0 on Sunday, that would have been the analysis. Well, listen, they conceded to one wonder free kick and that was it. This is the team you shall not cross, you know. Mm. But obviously, that's how the margins can be very fine.
It's true. Maybe one of the reasons, aside from the obvious, Southgate was so devastated, is that if they had managed to weather that storm in the second half and held out, it's a total masterclass. It's, you know, it's vindication on every front. And I'm sure that's occurred to him as well. On the scenes at Wembley, so I'm curious for your thoughts on this. You go to a lot of football matches. I'm sure you were looking on in just bemusement initially at the scenes in London. And then what happened, obviously, around the stadium became less harmless, I think. So seeing here, Harry Maguire's father suspected broken ribs. He was trampled on. There was a stampede, effectively, what seems to have happened, for instance, to Maguire's father. And these individual stories maybe are instructive because they give a sense as to the wider experience. Because we keep hearing these vague things like lots of people were terrified or certain families left the game half an hour in because they were so unsettled by what was going on. So picture the scene if you're Harry Maguire's dad. You're near a disabled entrance and the door shoots open and you get knocked over and then the mob trample all over you. And you have rib injuries and you're struggling to breathe by the end of the match. You know, horrific kind of a moment. You just happen to be wrong place, wrong time. Harry Maguire was making the point that he was just very, very relieved that neither of his two daughters or his nephew were on his father's shoulders when it happened. And you can imagine the scene then. Would the mob have stopped or would they have kept on running? I dare say some would have kept on running. So Maguire says, my dad was in the stampede. I've not spoken with him too much, but I'm pleased my kids didn't go to the game. That's just one story which kind of brings home a minor experience and maybe we can extrapolate much from that. So Matt Slater was on yesterday. Gab McCarty was on yesterday. It's quite noticeable in Gab's case. And I've heard Miguel Delaney as well. Those who were at the game have an extra sense of anger about the whole thing.
Yeah, it's very hard to get your head around it. As it is strange, like, being removed. I mean, I'm very lucky. I've been, I think, to the last, I think, six tournaments prior to this one. And I know you would have been at Brazil and would have been around the Euros, I think, you know, 2016 and so on. And I think, you know, you sometimes speak to people about these events and you sort of explain how sanitized it can be, how, like, homogenous all the stadiums can be, you know, that, like, you would have had, actually, I'm just thinking, going to South Africa and going to Brazil in particular, and Russia, actually, you would have had all these scare stories about safety and mind yourself on this and that. And yet, actually, like, you get to the final, and, I mean, particularly the final, because there's a certain prestige about a final. You feel very privileged to be there. But it's almost, there can be a fakeness about it too, because you're kind of looking around going, well, how many real supporters are actually here? Like, there's a big section of corporates there. And, you know, there's an allocation of fans. And listen, in some of those countries, there's no doubt their security operation ran smoothly because, to be blunt, they probably cleared a lot of the undesirables out of the place in some cases because they have the sort of authoritarian ability to do that. Whereas obviously England's situation at the moment as a country is fragile at a number of levels because it's purporting to be one thing, but obviously there's a there's an undercurrent there which it seems to have, they've lost control of it. And it's just very, it's very interesting. Like, listen, I've been to New Wembley loads of times, and the point about its remoteness, and I think it was Matt Slater speaking about that shopping centre off the Wembley Way. And it is true, like, it is, when you think about it, it is an area that's rife for congregation of that type, you know, and you can sort of see how it could become an issue. But I have to say, I just can't get my head around the fact that they lost control of it so badly or miscalculated it so badly. Like, they are generally very safe events, you know, and like, it's not something that would have struck me at all at the start of the competition, albeit maybe not thinking England would be there, but that the final would end up being a real, like, security issue. Like, this is a country that, for all its history, like, hosts, you know, Premier League games, you know, like, full capacity stadiums most of the time. Like, you travel through England on a Saturday, and you know, you could be in Birmingham, and, you know, train station, or Manchester, or any of the airports, and there's a hub of jerseys coming and going in different directions, and they're used to it. And how they ended up so ill-equipped for this, it's pretty staggering, to be honest. And I mean, it does seem like, I mean, I'm not, there's nothing original in what I'm saying in this point, but like, I think the point has been made by several contributors that if that had been a sellout and all the extra people had come up, like, there could have been very serious consequences, you know. Yeah. There could have been fatal consequences. I don't want to use those words sort of, you know, just flippantly, but it does seem like that was plausible with how this whole thing just completely escalated. And it's just I just can't believe it happened at a major tournament game. It's they're generally marshalled in such a way that they actually can be quite soulless. I mean, we all like a bit of soul and a bit of atmosphere, but the balance was lost there in a pretty drastic and horrible way.
No, it's incredible. It's incredible. The booze and the daylight cocaine really took hold, didn't it?
I know, and as, like, listen, some of this is just a reflection of, you know, society as well, and like, you know, without getting too sort of Helen Lovejoy about the whole thing, you know, like, it is, like, there was, when England were in a final, right, and everything's hyped up and pumped up, and it's an 8 o'clock kickoff on a Sunday, like, it's you know, at the end of a weekend of celebration and fervour coming off the back of a pandemic and everyone being locked up, you know, for a period of time, like, yeah. It's not exactly a rocket science to suggest that this could happen, you know. And to me, that's obviously you can be horrified by the scenes of what you've seen, and you can talk about, well, what does this say about society, and what does this say about England, and that's true. But like, you know, the scenes you're talking about there can be replicated in a lot of town centres, you know, on a Saturday evening at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, maybe in parts of this country too. So like, it's just that what staggers me is that generally those events, there's a preparation in such a way that's kept from the door, you know, and you don't see that out front. And how it wasn't anticipated, particularly when I think it was pointed out that this had happened during the Denmark game to a lesser degree. It's not as if this was completely taken, you know, and maybe even during the Germany game has been speculated as well too. So it's not as if Wembley, this was the Champions League final, and it was the only big game they'd done in a period of time. Like, they practically had a number of test events, to use the parlance that we're using all the time now, to build up for this absolutely massive event. Yeah. So how they could be caught so badly by it, it's sort of staggering, really. And yeah. I mean, I don't know what the consequences are going to be. I mean, people talk about the World Cup 2030 bid, and I get all of that, but like, the assumption there is that these bids, the World Cup bids, are processes where that they always go to like the most worthy candidate anyway. I mean, look where they've been and look where they're going. So I'm not sure if the integrity of the process exists in such a way that it can be compromised. But in rational times, you would think it should be quite damaging for them in terms of the punishment.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the government versus the players continues this amazing dynamic of the last 18 months in particular. So Tyrone Mings called out Priti Patel in beautiful fashion, I would have to say, called out her hypocrisy. He said, you don't get to stoke the fire at the beginning of the tournament by labelling our anti-racism message gesture politics and then pretend to be disgusted when the very thing we're campaigning against happens. Boom. Gazillion likes. Front page news. You know, that's the interesting dynamic at the moment, Dan, that the highest profile, most powerful representatives of one, working class, and two, people of colour, are footballers.
Yeah.
That's where we are. This really interesting dynamic. And they're at war with the government. They're calling out Patel. I said last night to Gab Marcotti, every Labour backbencher could jump up and down on every radio station about Priti Patel, and it wouldn't generate a percentage of the talk that Tyrone Mings has in one single tweet. That's the power these footballers have. Now, I've nothing more profound to say about it than just to note it. It's very interesting. I don't know.
It's a documentary in the making, isn't it? Like, yeah, you know, like it's overlapping with a time in history. Like, I remember in France in 2016, when England lost to Iceland, and a couple of the English journalists that were covering Ireland, like, obviously the Brexit vote happened at that time. And I remember, like, their leanings would have been, you know, they would have been Remainers in their mindset, and they sort of had this fear about what Brexit would mean. And it almost, you trace the fact that that happened when England lost to Iceland, and there was a lot of, like, people laughing at England getting knocked out of the Euros around that time. And, like, you can trace this point forward in history from there to now. Like, this English team are, as you said, they are sort of spokespeople for a generation, and they're more reflective of, obviously, a modern, maybe the modern, the real England than their parliament are, and their public representatives are. But I mean, like, exactly. I don't have much more to add myself, other than this is where it is. I suppose it's interesting. Where does it go from here? You know, like you know, in September, October, November, are people going to continue to take the knee? You know, for example, around Premier League games, around England international games, it had been noted in recent years by people covering the English team pre-pandemic that they felt that the away crowds were getting, they were just getting a bit on the wrong side of acceptable behaviour again. The no surrender chants were trending up, you know, and it will be interesting to see how this pans out, like, over a prolonged period of time towards Qatar, because, as I said, this English team is here to stay, I think, as a contender. So clearly the language around them is going to remain the same too.
Just find it interesting, because football, certainly for us over here, is one of the spheres which gives us the biggest insight into what's going on in the UK on the ground. You know, that's where so much dirty laundry is aired. And, like, Priti Patel, man, not a fan. Wasn't really a fan of Priti Patel from the time where she said the potential food shortages in Ireland over Brexit should be used as leverage against the backstop. You know, given the famine and everything, Dan, I just didn't feel like Priti Patel saying that was the best. But even her line, I mean, Tyrone Mings is just a brilliantly worded tweet, and just so well put. Even Priti Patel talking about the footballers taking the knee as gesture politics was so ludicrous. I mean, they are footballers. They're not politicians who can implement legislation. They have soft power. This is a high-profile, peaceful gesture. It's a perfectly fair route. Of course it's a gesture. They can't bring actual legislation to pass. Like, is Priti Patel going up to Rosa Parks saying, it's just a bit of a gesture, really, Rosa, when you think about it? I mean, what are you actually achieving with this, you know? So right from the off, they've just been so far on the wrong side of this thing. And, I mean, the rush now on Johnson's part, on Patel's part, to try and get on the right side of it is so transparent. And the footballers are not having any of it. That's why Mings's calling out of her was just so brilliant, because she could have kind of weaseled her way back to the right side of that argument. And, you know, a week is a long time, and so people forget her interview from a week ago, and he wasn't letting that go.
Yeah. And listen, the fact is those footballers are engaged in it. I mean, in some respects, like, a lot of the stuff coming out from the politicians on, you know, post-match on Sunday isn't hugely different to what would happen over here in a similar instance. Like, we've talked about it before, like, you know, when politicians get involved in sports, like, I just, my hands will go instinctively go over my face, you know, because it's just, it's never good. Like, it's generally opportunistic. It's generally the wind is blowing this way. Let's put this out there because this is what we need to be doing, you know. And, like, one of the stories that came out since Sunday, wasn't it a WhatsApp group of I think Tory MPs, where someone put in the point of view, would we be wrong to suggest that, you know, Rashford should concentrate more on penalties than politics? And this is obviously a line that was being mimicked on social media by a couple of the sort of over the top commentators who, you know, tend to get thrown onto the Sky News paper review for a bit of what we call balance nowadays, you know, for their take on it. But clearly what's different here with this English group of players, that they've decided you know, to find to use their voice. And rather than just let the bland sort of platitudes and tributes go by, they've chosen to attack them and point them out. And listen, there's a debate around this. You know, we probably had this, and you will have had this discussion countless times with countless guests, be they American guests or people covering a variety of codes and sports. Like, it's always there will be an old-fashioned view, you know, that, well, you know, you should stay, you know, sport and politics shouldn't mix, you know, but they're inherently interlinked, you know, you can't avoid that. And it's better that you have people that are, in my view, are afraid to voice their opinion. But by the way, that also means that they have to be able to sometimes voice a contrary opinion that people may not like, you know, do you know what I mean? Like
no,
you can't
totally
be a pro-Brexiteer sports person and you're not like, you don't get a pile on as well for expressing that view.
For sure. And like, I think Gab Mercati put it very well last night as well. A lot of these footballers, yes, they're stepping beyond the world of sport, but they're not going beyond the areas of their expertise. Marcus Rashford is talking about meals for children. He needed meals as a kid. Tyrone Mings is talking about the experience of not being a white person in the UK. If Rashford and Mings were talking about the fiscal policy of the UK over the next decade, then I think you'd be within your rights to say, well, lads, what do you know about it? Are you experts in this field? Like, they are staying in their lane in a way. And, you know, it's interesting. I think we in the sports world can overhype how worried the Tories are about this, really. Like yesterday, for instance, the Tories cut their foreign aid from 0.7% of gross national income to 0.5%. So the UN asked all the wealthy countries in the world, and Lord knows the divide between wealthy and poor is getting bigger and bigger by the second, to give 0.7% of their gross national income to the poorer countries of the world. And Boris, this was a stated commitment. All the fanfare you get with Boris a couple of years ago, we are doing this. You know, we take our responsibility on the global sphere very, very seriously. So yesterday they cut that. The cut amounts to $4 billion a year. You can imagine how much $4 billion would help. Like, John Major wrote a very strong letter saying we've gone from Great Britain to Little England. Theresa May stood up in the House of Commons and voted against her own party. Theresa May like made a rare speech in the House of Commons these days. So is Boris Johnson that worried about Tyrone Mings, a footballer he had never heard of until 2 weeks ago? Maybe not. Maybe not. We can overblow it. But then on the other hand, on the other side, Newsnight last night did a whole thing on the Marcus Rashford mural, and that thing is kind of blown up. So it's hard to know what effect it's having on everything, but it's very much part of the overall picture. By the way, sorry, I meant to say this to you before I forget. I have never reported anything on social media of a racist nature. Have you ever before
reported it? I think I do recall hitting the report function once or twice for a couple of aimed by high profile ex journalists turned commentators, I do recall. Yeah, but okay. maybe once or twice. But I vaguely recall doing it, but not with any clarity.
Grant. Yeah. Well, somebody I know, I was talking to them and they sent me screen grabs as well. So there were Instagram posts which, to the likes of Rashford and Saka, said that they didn't have the N-word, but they said things like, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to offend anybody, but I just think it illustrates the point. So if you're of a sensitive disposition, take it that I'm doing this in good faith and flick off the radio if you want. But these Instagram posts had references to bananas and go home to Nigeria, that kind of stuff. And so this person I know reported it and got a response saying, look, due to the high volume of complaints, the review team haven't viewed your report. However, our technology has found that this comment probably doesn't go against our community guidelines. Our technology isn't perfect and we're working to make it better. We understand this may be frustrating for you. I was thinking, my God, like, technology really is struggling if some of those words are not triggering issues in the context of these footballers. But it's kind of an interesting one. I hadn't ever reported something, so I didn't know how effective it was or otherwise. At the same time, you've some sympathy for these companies when I saw it. They've taken 33 million pieces of hate speech from Facebook and Instagram just between January and March this year, 93% of which before they were reported. Like 33 million pieces of hate speech in a 2 to 3 month spell.
Oh, yeah. And so, listen, there's an element of self-fulfilling prophecy about Sunday, because we all expected after the game that there would be abuse. And that's just like, for people of a particular mindset, it almost talking about it encourages them to give the abuse, if you know what I mean. Like it was an inevitable cycle that we were going to be in. Like, you know, it's because in so many cases, people are just in their own way, are just doing it for kicks, you know, doing it for a response. So, we will have that discussion again. There's absolutely no shadow of a doubt.
We sure will. To domestic matters. So finally, a chance for the League of Ireland to breathe and maybe capture some floating voters. There's European action at the moment. Sort of, yeah. Shamrock Rovers, Dundalk, Bohemians. Fill us in on what's been happening. I know you were at the Shamrock Rovers match last night.
Yeah, it's a bit of a frustration. I know the reasons for it. But I mean, it's like Shamrock Rovers playing a Champions League game last night against Slovan Bratislava. You know, who's the crucial goal was scored by Vladimir Weiss, a player who played in the Euros a couple of weeks back, a tournament which captivated the nation. You know, and it sort of feels like it's more underground than ever. And listen, there's a combination of factors with it. It wasn't shown on TV. Air Sport has probably missed in that regard. RTE didn't show it for whatever reason. And like I was watching like a really high end, like a really competitive, high quality Champions League tie, where Rovers came from 2 goals down in the first leg to be 2-0 up on the night. Brilliant Richie Towell goal, great atmosphere, controversial goal, and yet like they lose, so they're out of the Champions League, and it's almost like it didn't happen. You know what I mean? Like a lot of people will go through their life happily not knowing or caring that this happened or ever took place, and you sometimes find yourself kind of going, God, like we get energized by, say, the Dundalk going to the group stages and those games, and they all have to start from somewhere. And it's we have such a desire and passion for like football in this country, clearly. I mean, like, there's a million people watching the England games and stuff like that, and yet we still haven't found a way to transfer that interest locally in such a way that these games have to be shown. And listen, I know the reasons, you know, I'm not unrealistic. You know, people would say, well, you know, commercially it doesn't do as well as it should because that interest isn't there. But we have to get better at some stage and get to a stage where we can build that momentum going. So it was a great game, but they lost. And it just feels like you have to win your way into the news cycle if you're the Irish club. You can't, you know, you lose and it's under the radar. So they now, Shamrock Rovers, go into this new Europa Conference League, which is where Dundalk, Bowes and Sligo Rovers all are. Dundalk got through pretty comfortably, beat a team from Wales. And Bowes are playing in the Aviva tomorrow. 6,000 tickets were sold out in 24 hours. So there's a real good energy around Bowes. They're 1-1 with a team from Iceland who really, Bowes should be getting the job done at home. We have to demand high expectations of our teams, you know, in those type of ties. And Sligo Rovers 1-0 down to a team from Iceland who really, they shouldn't have lost that game last week. So there's a chance that all three teams in the Conference League will go through. And I would hope that at least two of them do. But it's a weird one, you know. Like it's for those of us who cover the game here and are interested in it, it's a really interesting time of the year because you're up against like good international players who are coming and going here. But it just feels like it's very much under the radar, more so than it has been. But listen, you're coming off the back of an amazing tournament, which is was just a fully. But I mean, Vladimir Weiss, as I said, he was there last night scoring a great goal. And he was playing against Spain a couple of weeks back. So the two worlds aren't that far removed, you know?
No, fair point. Fair point. How controversial were the controversial circumstances for Rovers?
Yeah, listen. So, I mean, some people who follow other clubs would point out Rovers maybe had a couple of decisions gone their way domestically in recent weeks. But there's so much at stake in this game, you know, that they would have been guaranteed at least 1.3, 1.4 million if they'd gone through. And, you know, like getting through one tie in that Champions League, it opens so many doors for you. Like it would have given them a guaranteed shot at group stage football, like a two-legged tie, worst case scenario in the Conference League, you know. So there's so much at stake. So they get from 2-0 down in the tie to 2-0 up on the night, 2-all in aggregate. And yeah, it was Roberto Lopez was fouled. You know, I had a reasonably good view of it at the time. He was going sort of back towards his own goal. He got clipped. It was almost that moment where people expect the play to stop, and it didn't. And three passes later, I think Vice is a great skill from him to score, as you would expect from like a top international player. But Stephen Bradley's anger was, he said, the fourth official said on the sideline that it was a foul. He admitted it was a foul, which isn't much consolation when the referee is pointing to the halfway line. And it just took momentum. Now, they actually had chances later on to push it to extra time, and they played pretty well. I think their frustration will be, now it was 36 degree heat or 34 degree heat last week, and they struggled badly, but they left themselves with a real uphill task, and they'll come away from the night thinking, actually, yes, this was a tie. They could have got over this hurdle. And as I said, if they get over that hurdle, it's such a big hurdle. It opens so many doors. And that's the frustration. You can't get it back. You know, you can't get a mulligan on it. It's done, you know. And you really, hopefully they'll give it a go in the Conference League. But I think that one is going to sit with them for a while.
I see Patrick McElhenney is going to Derry at the end of the season.
Yeah, so that was a bit of a rumpus last week. So Vinnie Perth and Dundalk, after winning 4-0, and you would think it's a good news night at Dundalk, and they haven't had too many of them recently. Vinnie Perth does his press conference, all happy, you know, all good. And then we're sitting in the stand 10 minutes later, and Derry City press release that they're signing McElhenney at the end of the season, who's just played brilliantly in the game. And they also said they want to sign him now. Vinnie Perth is obviously pressed for a further comment. He's pretty irate and unhappy. His old assistant, Rory Higgins, is the manager of Derry, so there's that aspect of it there too. And yeah, like, I mean, the Dundalk unravelling is continuing, even though on the pitch they're actually looking, they've been looking better. There's clearly player, you with Chris Shields on, a brilliant interview a couple of weeks back. He's left, McElhenney is leaving. These are stars of 2016 who are seeing their future better served elsewhere. And I think okay, that's well, pretty
sorry, you've answered the question I wanted to ask, really. McElhenney's departure here, if we're to put it in context, you would see this as a member and a really good player, that core, one of the core members of Dundalk's golden period, looking at the club and saying, I don't really know if this is the place for me anymore, as opposed to McElhenney somehow on the wane and Dundalk happy for him to go.
Oh, yeah. He's not on the wane, although I think maybe some people there at the club were concerned about his injury record, and maybe that's why they're more amenable to it. But the fact is, like, Dundalk have allowed all their players, bar one, to run out a contract at the end of the season. So they're all entitled to speak to anyone else. Yes, like Chris Shields had family reasons for going to Linfield. You know, Patrick McElhenney is from Derry. It was expected he would go back there probably eventually at some stage. But the fact is, if Dundalk, like, you know, Dundalk are if they were doing their things right, they'd certainly not be in a situation where I don't think these contracts would be running out all at once at the end of the year, if you know what I mean. I think, you know, you would have had one or other of those players, you would have expected their contract to be done a while back to take it out of the equation. And like I mean, Dundalk, like, their European record in recent seasons is really good. They're, like, in terms of the European seedings and rankings, like, they're really high up there. They're above some really good clubs. So if they qualify for Europe, they're always going to be seeded and have a good chance of going through a few rounds. But as it stands, things have gone so badly there this year, they may not even make Europe next year and capitalise on this wonderful seeding that they have. So much has been a let run to waste up there. It's very hard to get your head around it because they were so close. They were so close to doing something sustainable. And yeah, things have gone askew quite considerably.
Yes. No, that is a pity. Dan McDonald of the Irish Independent. Thanks, Dan, for this evening. We'll talk next week, I'm sure.
Thanks, Joe. We'll talk to you soon.
Cheers, Dan McDonald there. Football on Off the Ball is with thanks to Paddy Power's Save Our Game, donating €10,000 to Irish football for every goal England scored at the Euros, which meant €110,000 in the end, all with thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, do visit gamblingcare.ie.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power's Save Our Game. Is your bookie giving you jack? Then you haven't tried Paddy Power. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Well, so far you've heard my voice, but then I brought two friends along. Next on the mic is my man, Jer. Come on, Jer, sing that song.
David Tyler.
Subscribe now to the OTB Football podcast stream wherever you get your podcasts
and download the OTB Sports app.